Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the session number 6 of Deceptive Nature. Here are the keywords on the board. Indra, Indriya, Indriya Bhavana Sutta. These are the keywords today. We don't necessarily, we are not going to define these words. These are a few keywords that we will be using. Now, we don't have a sub-theme for this discussion, actually. What we are going to do is, if you need one, this is no runaway, no way to run away but face. You can run away. No way to run away but face. We are going to discuss that is the sub-theme for today. Now, today's discussion is based on the Indriya Bhavana Sutta, which occurs in the Majjhima Nikaya. I think, as far as I remember, it's 159 sutra. Maybe correct, I may be wrong. 159. So this, anyway, is in the Majjhima Nikaya. When you Google for Indriya Bhavana Sutra, you will pull out several translations. I always use Venerable Tanisaro Bhikkhu's translations. And O Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations. They are very clear, consistent, and also don't distort the original meaning in Pali, Indriya Bhavana. Now, Indriya Bhavana Sutra is about the development of faculties. That's what the term means. Indriya is the faculties, and Bhavana is development of faculties. Now, I would like to start with a pre-Buddhist term, Indra. According to the earliest Vedic texts, you know, the Hinduism is based on the four Vedas, Rig, Yajur, Saman, Atharvan. According to the earliest Veda, that is Rig Veda, Hindus believe that it dates back to dates back to 8,000, 9,000 BCE, but there are a lot of differences of opinion. Religious people would say that it is like a primordial thing. So anyways, Rig Veda is one of the oldest Vedic text. So according to the earliest Vedic text, scripture, Indra was the creator god. He created the world. However, as Brahminism, Vedic religion, if we use an universal term, because Vedic religion has been through so many transformations that given the era, given the age that we talked about, it could be called the Vedic religion, Brahminism, or nowadays Hinduism. So it has been through so many philosophical transformations. However, according to the earliest earliest text of Vedic religion, Indra was the creator. Later, with Brahma becoming the creator later on, Indra got demoted. He fell from his grace. I always love these epic stories. Indra fell from his grace and he was demoted. Later, Brahma would become the creator. And Indra would be reduced to a god, simple G-O-D, god, who would be in charge of the firmament, the god of the firmament, the sun and the moon and the horizon, and people would still, when some, I know some religious people from Vedic practitioners from Kashmir, and they have told me that when they see the sunrise and the sunset, they would think about Indra, because that is where you can see the horizon. It is the fine line between the terrestrial domain and the celestial domain. So Indra later fell from his, he was demoted. Indra later became, and also, however, Indra is also revered in Buddhism, in Buddhist texts. In Buddhist texts, Indra is identified with Sakha or Chakra, the god king, the king of the first two heavens. However, when I speak with my Hindu friends, after a philosophical dialogue, sometimes we need a moment of relaxation. Sometimes we use our humor, and also and one Hindu friend told me it's okay that Indra got demoted from my religion, and he got promoted in new religion. Indra. So Indra is one of the synonyms for God King Chakra or Sakha. S-A-K-K, Sakha is the Pali word. S-R-A-K-R-A, Chakra is the Sanskrit word. Now, here's the meaning. We are not going to talk about God Indra, but Indriya. Indriya, I-N-D-R-Y-A, Indriya, which comes from the term Indra. And by the way, Indra in Sanskrit, Indra literally means power. Power, might. Indra means power, might. Now, Indra, the word Indriya is derived from Indra. Now, how this etymology within bracket, in parenthesis, Indra plus ya. When you add the word ending ya, suffix ya. Suffix ya, ya means belonging to. Belonging to. Ya means, so Indra, I-N-D-R-A, Indra plus ya, ya, suffix ya. Now, Indra is the name of a god. That's the earliest creator god in Vedic religion. Later he fell from his position, and he was, however, he reappeared within the text, Veda itself, but that this time he was not as powerful as Brahma. So that's why in theistic religions people call God by different names. Sometimes they argue with each other, no, he's not the god, this is the one. Obviously they refer to the same one. I remember when during the 9/11, after the 9/11, I think it was Karen Armstrong, the BBC commentator, he's a well-known writer, and she wrote several books, History of God, Battle for God, Buddha, different books. And I think this in her book, Karen Armstrong's book, Battle for God, somewhere, she says that people who believe in God say that they believe in the same God. I wonder whether, now the people wonder whether it's the same God. Why? After the 9/11 blast, Bin Laden said, "Thanks, God." And at the same time, the victim said, "God, please save us." Could be two different gods. Mm-hmm. She's very humorous. Without offending anyone, that's what she talked about. So over the history, people identify God in different ways. According to some, God is not, it doesn't have a, God is not an individual, it's simply the power, the universal power, and all. There are different definitions. However, when it comes to Indriya, meaning belonging to Indriya, part of Indra, meaning limbs. Limbs. That's what Indriya means, limbs. Our organs, our limbs, our hands. Arms and legs, yeah. So internal indriyas, that is like a heart, our internal organs, like heart, kidneys, lungs, etc. Or our hands and legs, indriya. So Indriya literally means belonging. So without limbs, we are powerless. Right? We can't survive. We need that's the psychological meaning. Indriya. So
You said earlier that Indra was, as it were, demoted to look after the firmament.
Yeah.
What is the definition of the firmament?
The firmament is, according to the religious imagination, firmament is the boundary between terrestrial existence and celestial existence, like heavens and earthly existence. So beyond the horizon, above the horizon, so you beings living beyond the horizon, they are, by definition, they are celestial. Those who live below the horizon, they are terrestrial or earthbound. So that is the definition, general Indian religious definition of the firmament. So that made me curious as to why God Chakra in Buddhism is identified as he is the one who would constantly deal with earthly things, right? Whenever a virtuous human being is in trouble, and he would get his seat, his throne heated up, and so that he would stand up, and why he couldn't, why his seat is now so hard, and it's like fire, because that is when he would just look at the human world and see, because a virtuous person is going through some trouble, so that he would come down and help. So there are a lot of stories of chakra. So there's a universal, how to say, universal agreement as to the fact that God King Indra or Chakra is a celestial god, but at the same time, his duty is to oversee, in Buddhist language, to radiate kindness, to come to the rescue of virtuous human beings. And further, there are four guardian gods also.
Is Chakra a Buddhist concept, or is it also found in
Vedas? Chakra is a Buddhist concept. It's a Buddhist concept, yeah. However, over time, you know, this is how religious concepts get assimilated. There are a lot of other things. One example, like the Laughing Buddha in Chinese Buddhism. He was a local, according to Chinese, he was the most stingy man in his community. He was a trader. He was so stingy that he wouldn't even have a good food. And all of one day, when he was thinking about his wealth, he thought to himself, well, I'm old now. What if I die? Somebody will occupy my wealth. The long story short, then why should I let an unknown person to grab my properties, my wealth, so that I must let people that I know benefit from my wealth. So that is why all of a sudden he had this change of mind, and all it was a breakthrough in his thinking. So he started donating, giving, and later he became a well-known philanthropist. And when Buddhism, it was a local, I think before Buddhism was introduced, there was Taoism and Confucianism. So when Buddhism got highly assimilated with Taoist and Confucius study teachings and also animistic beliefs, now Buddhism became, they are called, Chinese people say that religion in China is a huge tree. There are three branches, Taoism, Confucianism and Buddhism. When Buddhism got assimilated with local Chinese beliefs, he came to be identified as a bodhisattva. And in Chinese, in general Chinese Buddhist imagination, Buddhist belief, they don't see much difference between bodhisattva and Buddha. So, So that is why nowadays you can say Buddha rice, Buddha drinks, and all these things, right? So that is one fine example of how religious concepts get assimilated with each other. So that's.
Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is that process sounds very human.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just sort of almost by chance saying, "Oh well, I think I'll take this idea," and then somebody else inflates it into something much more important.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that is when that is the role of religion, mm-hmm. rather than the Dhamma. Right. Sometimes people, I personally believe that religion is like religion is the icing, different icing layers of the cake. Sometimes you don't see the cake at all. The cake layer has become thinner and thinner and thinner, and people mostly eat the icing or the sugary stuff, unhealthy part. So that's how religion is. That's one of the reasons why this sutra also talks about and hints at that. Now, indriya, so that means indriya also means faculties, limbs or faculties. Now, in the Indriya Bhavana Sutra, what Buddha means by indriya is our sensual the faculties, our senses. Our faculties, our senses. So the eyes, the ears, nose, tongue, and skin. Now, Indriya Bhavana Sutra talks about the development of faculties. Now, hear the story. There was a famous Brahminical teacher called different name, Parasarya, Parasavi, Parasali. It's pronounced differently. Parasavi. Now, Brahmin Parasa was a well-known teacher, who was a Brahmin. So one of his students paid a visit to the Buddha. Now, he was someone, a young student of Brahmin Parasa, and that he was now visiting the Buddha. Now, Venerable Ananda was there too at that moment. Now they had the chit-chat, Samichi Kata. We talked about Samichi Kata, chit-chat. Before you start a dialogue, you know, because serious dialogue, we always talk about each other's whereabouts, or how we've been. Now, after the chit-chat, Samichi Kata, Buddha asked Parasarya's student, How do you, a teacher, explain development of faculties? What he meant by was, during the Buddha's time, Indriya Bhavana was one of the famous practices. Indriya Bhavana. People would, from any religious background, would know what Indriya Bhavana means. So Indriya, the faculties, it also means our limbs and our organs as well as our senses, the five senses. In this sutra, indriya particularly means the sense faculties. How do you, would you tell me how your teacher explains indriya bhavana, the development of faculties? Then the young student opened up and he said, "Okay, sir, this is how my teacher explains the development of faculties, meaning how to." So the purpose of development of faculties in Indriya Bhavana, in general Indian spiritual practice, was that you need to train your sense faculties. That's what Indriya Bhavana means. You need to don't let your eyes run after whatever it would like to see, because you need to be aware of what your eyes would do. Go after. So it's all about your eyes, the connection between your eyes, perception, eyes between eyes and images, ears and sounds, nose and smell, tongue and taste, and so skin and tactile sensations, touch. So this would be, that is the whole purpose of spiritual practice in India, regardless of the religion. The purpose is development of faculties, to control, have control over your sense faculties. So, and then he said, hereafter I'm going to use the word Indriya Bhavana itself. So this is how my teacher explains. And he said, when you see an image, don't look at and close your eyes. When you hear a sound, don't listen to it. When you smell something, stop it. Don't smell it. Block it. And when you taste something, so you have to stop that. And when your skin touches something, feels something, so you have to block it. Meaning, run away from experience. You are not supposed to experience that. Then Buddha, you know, Buddha uses humor then. He said, well, my friend, in that case, someone who is born totally blinded doesn't have to, he's automatically has achieved his goal because he doesn't have to, there's no way that he can see. Someone who was born deaf is already highly spiritual. Why? He has no way to listen. And it's so the Buddha went through, he gave a simple, quickly went through, explained with reference to the sense faculty, explained that. So now, Parasari's student, he got lost in his words. And Buddha was waiting for him to answer, but he wouldn't say a word. And he was silent and red-faced, and he didn't have a say. And Venerable Ananda was there. However, Buddha wanted to teach the student, now he had no answer. And Buddha turned to Venerable Ananda and said, Ananda, do you see that how Paras, according to his explanation, do you see how Parasariya, his teacher, teaches his teacher's way of developing the faculties? Yes, sir, I see. Ananda, do you see the way you must do the development of faculties? Yes, Venerable Sir, please explain. Now, see the Buddha's tactics now. However, he was not leaving. He really wanted to listen to Buddha, but he doesn't have a word to say. He was lost in his words. So that is when Buddha explains. Now, when you, in the sutra, and it is this Indriya Bhavana Sutra that you, at least for me, I don't know in your case, to me, the most beautiful definition of bhavana or meditation occurs in this sutra, Indriya Bhavana Sutra. Then Buddha explains it. When your eyes perceive images and your ears sounds, your nose smell, your tongue taste, and your skin, anything that leads to tactile sensations, anything touch. Don't resist it. I know some of my Buddhist friends do that. I told them, that is the Parasariya method, that's not the Buddhist way. Some even get angry. Why did I look at him? Well, sometimes people ask me, Bhante, I never want to look at that person, he or she. But I don't know why I was not supposed to look at. I said, there's no way called I'm not supposed to look at. As far as I know, there's nothing called not supposed to look at. You happen to look, you happen to see. So then Buddha explains, you can resist your perceptions because it's a natural process. Naturally, your eyes would look for something pleasant, images. And it's a different story that you end up seeing something unpleasant. Naturally, we want to see, our ears would look for sounds like music. And we might end up listening to something unpleasant. always want to taste something sweet. It is different that we might taste something sour that we hate. And we would always love something good smell something good like perfume. Right? Sometimes we will have to encounter the foul smell of carcass or the dead body somewhere, and so forth. Now, if you resist to the extent that you get your sense faculties, your indriyas gratified by the pleasant things that you come across, to the same extent or beyond, so you get agitated by what your senses experience. So always, our sense faculties go through the fluctuation between liking and disliking, between favoring and opposing, between attachment and aversion, between desire and fear. And it is a natural process. What Buddha in the sutra Buddha explains, whenever you see something, and that something gives you some pleasant feelings, or the next moment you will see something and that would arise within you some unpleasant feelings. And what in developing your faculties, what you have to do is just to observe as they are, as it is. This is called yatha bhuta jnana dasana, right? So this is the hardest thing in Buddhist practice, to see things as they really are. You might have come across that phrase a lot of times. To see things as they truly are, to see things as they as they really are. However, according to Indriya Bhavana Sutra, people would find it difficult even to see things as they appear to be. Even the very appearance is problematic to us. Then how could you see as the things as they truly are? So that is where the meditation comes in, bhavana. Now, I was going to say, I said that the most beautiful definition of bhavana meditation occurs in this sutra. The sutra, it says, when your sense faculties experience something, indriyas, when your indriyas experience arambana. I think we did talk about that word before, arambana. A long A, R A, M M A, N A. Arambana. Arambana means objects. Indriya sense faculties, arambana means sense objects. Sense faculties and sense objects. Now, when your eyes grasp or perceive an image, what really matters is not the image itself, not the indriya itself, but to see the reaction. Whether it is a wholesome reaction or an unwholesome reaction. So whether it's pleasant reaction or an unpleasant reaction. In the sutra, Buddha talks about the way we react to our perceptions. Now that is all about. Otherwise, there's no way to run away from images. You can block your eyes from seeing images. You can block your nose from experiencing a smell, whether good or bad. You can't block your ears from experiencing sounds. If you do that, that's not practical. That's when Buddha said that it's better to be reborn. It would have been better if you were born totally blinded. Then you would have, so that you would have come to this world with innate, enlightenment built in. With built-in enlightenment. like the cars and gadgets and the devices, kind of built-in capabilities, right? So that you will be that you'd have come to this world with innate enlightenment built into your being. So that's what Buddha means. So the whole point is to see the level of reaction, to see the level or the nature of reaction. If the reaction is if you see the reaction, however, now in modern day in psychology, it's a fancy word too. Don't react, but simply respond. Right? However, according to deep psychology, it's still reaction because there's an act. There's an action. The way you observe the action is reaction. So yeah, the Buddha has used the word reaction. So however, in psychology and in modern day counseling psychology, people say, don't react, simply respond. But how could the respond is a negative response. So that's a problem with the terminology. But we would forget reaction versus response. According to this sutra, we do react anyway. Now, I want my eyes only to see something that pleases me, that brings me happiness. Now, when I see something that gratifies my eyes so that I can create some pleasant feelings thereof, so that's always I want, nothing else. However, in my effort to see something good, I ended up seeing something unpleasant. Then what happens? I get angry. Why did I get angry? Because that's not what I wanted. So, and whereas when you use meditative perception, Indriya Bhavana, meditative perception, the first thing is it could be a little disastrous sometimes. It's naturally you get angry when you see something unpleasant, when you hear something unpleasant. When you happen to, like, children hate medicine. Right? Children hate medicine. Whenever you say medicine, children make a face. Even adults do. Whenever you say ice cream, aha, Bhante's favorite. When children hear ice cream, and then they are happy, they get elated. Now, by nature, people hate medicine. By nature, people love ice cream. So that is what our inner... That's what our body, our inner being wants, always something pleasant. Now, there's nothing wrong with the way you, see. You don't have to block your eyes from seeing. You don't have to block your ears from listening. Otherwise, it's the natural difference to sometimes when you hear something, when you go through something that's traumatizing and you cover your eyes, but that doesn't mean that you are able to block. You still hear. Now, so the bhavana is a natural thing. It's a very pleasant, steady way of dealing with your perceptions. This is the definition. When your indriyas touch aramanas, when your sense faculties pursue something, whether pleasant or unpleasant, immediately you have to start observing the reaction, your reaction. That's when Buddha said the best, that's why I say the best definition of meditation. Now, as a result of your observation, this is the central part of the definition. There's a pleasant feeling that has arisen in my mind. There's an unpleasant feeling that has arisen in mind. A better translation, there's a sweet feeling that has arisen in my mind or arising in my mind. There's a bitter feeling that has arisen in my mind or that is arising in my mind, because mostly we average people only notice once something has happened. However, over time, when you continue to practice meditative observation, you can see when anger is now coming. Not anger has come and gone already. Right. So when there's a sweet feeling that has arisen in my mind, or when there's a bitter feeling that has arisen in my mind, or there is a bittersweet feeling. There's a bittersweet feeling, or a feeling that is neither bitter nor sweet has arisen in my mind. I have to tell myself, this feeling is not something permanent. It is a reflection of my reaction. It is the result of my reaction. And it is not permanent. Based on my conclusion of my own reaction, whether it is sweet or bittersweet, or neither bitter nor sweet, I must not make permanent assumptions. It is conditionally arising. It is based on cause and effect, and it is something very gray. This is the definition of meditation. In case you miss out certain parts, now when you observe, based on the nature of your perception, whether it is something pleasing or something traumatizing, something that you like or something you dislike, something you hate, immediately based whatever you have to say, okay, I'm breaking it down to layman's language. Now, my feeling is sweet. Wow, what a sweet feeling. Oh, what a disgusting feeling. What a bitter feeling. Oh, what a bittersweet feeling. Oh, what a feeling that I can't understand. I don't know whether it's sweet or bitter. Whatever it is, I know this is not something permanent. It's based on my reaction. So I should not see this, my reaction, my experience as something permanent. Based on my experience, I should not decide that this is something permanent that is going to affect me positively or negatively forever.
But isn't it more or less the same as the Western psychology's kind of understanding of response?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is like you decide, you don't react automatically.
Yeah, that's where that the reaction versus response is there. Mm-hmm. And then I also use that term in my counseling sessions. Now, there's a reason why Buddha only used the word reaction. Over time, no matter how pleasant your response is, and later you are back in the square one, and again you are back to your negative behavior. So finally, that sukha and dukkha we explained before. Sukha and dukkha. So su is present, positive, ka is meaningless, du is negative, and ka is meaningless. We always start, we feel very positive when we feel present. We find is like we have achieved something that we had always wanted to achieve. But over time, that experience diminishes, and then you are back in, then unless you repeat that experience, and you will be the same, you'll be back in your same negative persona. Because of that, but especially strictly in a spiritual sense, in higher spiritual practice, we have to put both present and both response and reaction, both, or in if I use the Buddhist terms, present reaction and unpleasant reaction in the same category. Why? Because you might get deluded by either one. That's when you have present dhyana, you will always expect things to be only to be pleasant. When that doesn't happen, so that is where Buddha says that it is better to be optimistic, because pessimism is a slow killer. We are encouraged to be optimistic, not because optimism is the final thing that we are supposed to do. To be on the safe side of survival, we need to be optimistic. Otherwise, we need to achieve something higher that is realistic. So that is this. I don't know who said that. It's a Western saying, I guess. Buddha's teaching is a source of not being pessimistic or optimistic, but being realistic. Now, in this sutra, we have to be realistic. Now, sooner or later, our present experience might turn against us. Because we might say, how do that? We discount, so we reverse, so we downgrade. We devalue our present experience over time. When the experience fails to keep us motivated to the same level, and so we get fed up with our experience. That's what happens when you eat the same recipe, same food, you feel like trying something else. When you wear the same perfume, you need a different one. And you've been wearing the same perfume, maybe cologne, maybe for 5 years. Now, all of a sudden in the shopping mall, you get a smell, permeating smell of perfume. And I should buy that. And then you buy that, you change your brand. And over time, you experience someone wearing your old brand. I think that's way better. I don't like this one. No. This is the kind of battle that we got. This is called the constant inner battle, inner struggle between wanting and not wanting, and favoring and opposing, and loving and hating, and between attachment and aversion. Yes, Alex.
I'm not quite understanding. So you're saying that if we taste something nice and we over time dull that niceness, it doesn't have any effect on us.
Yeah.
You're saying we get bored with it, so that when we come to something different, we have an exaggerated reaction to it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a conclusion. Yeah.
Essentially,
so,
in line with the dopamine idea.
Exactly, yeah, right.
If you repeat something, it gives you pleasure, you're progressively losing that pleasure.
That's right, yeah. Completely. You go down, yeah.
Earlier you talked about anger in this as one of those sort of parts of that to and fro process.
But yeah.
You didn't mention it just in your recent example.
You can explain, yeah. Could you elaborate on that further?
Well, when you first mentioned it, I thought that the idea of anger coming into the way the reactions change from liking what you see or disliking what you see, and I couldn't quite identify with it. But
anger versus joy, again.
Right.
Yeah, anger versus joy. It could be the same, two different reactions. But you can, in the case of the negative experience out of anger, then you have to struggle to remove it from your mind. You have to forget it. And at the same time, when the reaction or the experience is a positive one, and there's another struggle because you need to retain it. Again, in both cases, we get frustrated. So that is when, before we open up a file for each and create imprints, it's better to observe and delete certain things. There's no way to avoid, but observe and let go.
Yes, it's complicated because you said anger, the reverse being joy, but then anger can be the reverse of approval. Or,
that's true.
So it does get very complicated, but I suppose that's what we're trying to process.
The whole point here is, according to this sutra, now, we don't use the word response and reaction here. Let's stick only to the word reaction. Okay. Now, for this class, okay? Now, when you experience something pleasant and you like it, let's say that is a reaction, so you like it, then you can, okay, this is the only thing that I want to experience in my life. And the next moment, you happen to get angry due to something that you see something unpleasant. then what would you feel? You'd feel, I never want to have this feeling again. Mm-hmm. Having that feeling forever, and that positive feeling forever, and never having that negative feeling again, never again in my life. See, in both cases, you have to exert a lot of, so you have to put a lot of burden on that. So both positive experience and negative experience become a burden to yourself. So that is why rich people are unhappy. If money can buy everything, why they are angry and why they are frustrated, why they live in fear? See?
Can you substitute other negative emotions besides anger?
Yeah.
Jealousy.
Jealousy.
Disappointment or sadness.
Yeah, sadness. Actually, there are about 1,500, as Buddha says, 1,500 such negative feelings, sadness.
Negative.
Yeah.
That can be any
negative feeling, yeah. Sometimes you can really explain what it is. There are certain mixed feelings. Mm-hmm. For sure, those feelings are affecting you negatively, but you don't know what it is. It happens a lot. It could be anything. What we can easily feel is like jealousy, anger, because anger itself are different types of anger. Now, fear comes from the root of anger. Fear. When you are angry, you don't even want to look at your enemy, opponent, and you walk away. Why do you walk away? In fear. You are not willing to face, but you think that is my personality. I don't want to. However, if you can say hi to your opponent, that's the way you tame him. Thereby you prove that you can stand your opponent.
Is it how Buddhism views Buddhism, anger and fear? Fear is a derivative of anger.
Anger, yes, yeah. It comes from the root of anger, yeah. Fear comes from the root of anger.
But there are also positive sides to anger.
Mm-hmm.
It strengthens you to confront the foe, maybe, or to do the right thing, which may be unpopular to other people.
Yeah, it happens. And so that is where the Buddha says that patikasanya is natural. Sense of resistance is the more subtle form of anger. But Buddha says even an experienced meditator with lots of experience would still get a sense of resistance or patikasanya in good faith. Let's say, as a meditator, as a leader, as someone in the admin, you have to maintain certain standards. You made the commitment to certain standards in your organization, in your spiritual life. When others don't live up to those standards that you have set, and you get angry. So that's why Buddha has a very liberal approach to patikasanya, sense of resistance. I know a lot of leaders, I know a lot of highly regarded monks also, they get, sometimes you would say, okay, the monk is angry, but I don't rush to call it anger. Why? Because I would have then passed a wrong message to the audience. And I would simply explain it rather than say that in a few words. You know, this is the way you should, let's say, the monk. It happened many times in Sri Lanka, one of my superior monks, and he was always, since he occupied the admin, and he would always look restless. And there's a saying that in Sri Lanka, when I became the abbot of a temple that I founded years ago in Canada, one child who had migrated to Canada like a few months ago, and he could speak Sinhalese, and he came to me and he said he was familiar with the monks. He approached me and said, "Bhante, will you be an angry monk hereafter?" I said, "Why? All the head monks are angry." That is the child's experience. What happens is, this is what happens. I cannot say yes. I think I need to explain this. Now, this is called normal anger, as you see. This is the sense of resistance. Because when others don't live up to the standard set by the organization or set by the head monk, and then he goes through so that he becomes restless. But restlessness it also comes from the root of anger. You become shaky. So that's why we use patika sanya rather than anger. Dosa, D-O-S-A, dosa. Dosa means, that's the Pali word for anger. However, dosa literally means fault. Fault. Dosa, because you happen to find fault with others. Sometimes you find fault with yourself. You may be at fault with yourself because you lose your awareness. Now, it's natural. So it's the part, resistance, sense of resistance. You resist someone means you put up a barrier, you put up some distance, but you feel uncomfortable talking to that person any longer. You don't like that. So, but that's natural. One thing we have to say repeatedly, naturally, I mean, by definition, our reactions, whether good or bad, whether negative or positive, ethically they are neither good nor bad. They are natural. But based on the life, based on where you work and live, so you have to define. I know in psychology sometimes say that. I know some psychologists have told me when they look for certain healthcare settings, and they had told me that Bhante, I showed my anger to my colleagues going through under my training. Otherwise they wouldn't listen to me. But there's a good, he has a, as you said, that when it comes to anger, if I use the same word anger, what matters is your motive. Your motive is good. So natural, it's you get angry quite naturally, but your motive is not to attack someone. But you become frustrated as to why other colleagues don't live up to their commitments. Why they fail to stick to their commitments. Mm-hmm. So
I suppose annoyance is a better word.
Annoyance. Yeah, it's a good. Yeah, it's a better word. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, a lot of people, I got annoyed by so and so, right?
Yes.
People say that a lot.
Is the resistance the same as defensive anger? Like someone is unpleasant to you, or they invade your space, or they...
Defensive anger. Yeah, defensive anger is quite natural, because it's built into our built into our inner being, and it's part of our survival too.
Yeah.
Survival. Sometimes. The overuse of sometimes is too much is that when without getting provoked by someone, and sometimes you tend to attack someone due to inferiority complex. Well, that is not seen as something ethical. It's still natural, but it's not acceptable. Whereas you have to resist. There's no way. So that is why an indriya bhavana here. Bhavana means continuous development of cultivation. Why? By nature, we react negatively. That is why indriya bhavana is one of the hardest things. If it is that simple and easy, it wouldn't have taken a bodhisattva many millions of lifetimes to complete his qualification to become the Buddha. It's very hard. It's quite natural. So sometimes the only struggle we have to do is when it's very hard for us to make up our mind and say, okay, I got angry by somebody's action, behavior. Most of us are not in a position to go to the extent and say, well, that anger, I'm not supposed to see that anger as real, because I'm not supposed to respond, react, because this is quite natural, and this is based on cause and conditions. We cannot be that philosophical or understanding to overcome our anger. So only after anger has come and gone and done some damage to us, do we tend to see why we were angry. But that's natural. So it's quite natural. But based on your experience, sometimes you could feel when you are getting angry. Now we are in the middle of getting angry. You are in the middle of getting sad, and all of a sudden then you feel, no, the last time also this happened. However, if it is a first-time experience, you wouldn't be able to stop that. However, it's, again, even if you have been through that like millions of times, you are not supposed to block your feeling, but otherwise it is unhealthy. It's unhealthy, you have to let go, it's natural. So in order to... And Buddha has shown the middle grounds. That's the purpose of walking away. When you can't stand that anymore, you walk away, or you do deep breath. Because when you force you to not see, not experience, over time that could invite some health issues.
Is this related to guarding the sense doors?
Yes. Absolutely.
It's already related to
guarding the sense doors in the sense of faculties.
Faculties. Yeah.
The sense faculties.
Sense faculties, yeah.
Is that Indriya Sangvara?
Indriya Sangvara, yes. Indriya Sangvara is restraint. Indriya Sangvara. Restraint on your senses. But it comes from constant awareness of your reaction, response, the way you look at, observe.
Mm-hmm. There's a difference between anger and... So anger, through your experiential karma, you kind of build, like, you don't like somebody, so you see them, you get angry.
Mm-hmm.
Or this, something somebody said to you, first you hear it, then you have to think about it, and then you get angry.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are other things, like a sense of sweetness, which is inbuilt to our evolved mechanisms. We're evolved to like sweet things and to reject sour things.
Yes.
So as soon as a sweet thing touches your tongue, that's different to anger. That fires the neurons to make you like it.
Yes.
So how do you deal with that?
Yeah, that is better than dukkha. Because it's always better to have pleasant feelings. That is, we are on the worldly level, Buddha encourages us to have pleasant feelings. Why? Because it's way better than having negative feelings. That is when Buddha appreciates beauty, and even that's a karmic thing you mentioned. So while it could be a new experience that angers you, or could be based on your prior experience also. So always the pleasant experience is better, is recommended, because at least it motivates you. It helps you survive. Whereas if you only experience negative things, it could be detrimental to your survival. So that is why Buddha appreciates aesthetics, pleasant things, singing, dancing, eating, and company, and all these things. So because that's better, and then better than negative ones, and also there are two things. In the case of lay people, you are free to choose. Whereas when it comes to this sutra, is more into higher spiritual practice. Otherwise, an ordinary person wouldn't be able to stick to the guidelines as explained in this sutra. I myself, being a monk myself, I find it difficult to do that. Because I live with the society. Over time, I get my ability diminished, reduced, so that I have to make time for myself and say, sometimes I would have insulted someone, I would have reacted to someone, unless I see that later on, or someone comes to me and say, Banti, you're not supposed to behave like that, or respond like that, react like that, that would go unnoticed. So that is why we take preventive measures. But over time, preventive measures would serve as a, would alert you to a forthcoming, a negative experience that is kind of forthcoming. Like, for example, based on the environment, the surroundings. So I remember that when I attended, Japanese classes in the university and the embassy in Sri Lanka, there were some students who had studied in Japan. They would always offend me. And then they said, somebody has never been to Japan. Our Japanese is good. During the first few weeks, I felt it really. And later on, I made myself happy. One day, I meditated on my Japanese studies, not on Buddha or anything else, because that was based on my experience. I told myself, I was one of the three students who had never been to Japan, had never learned Japanese. Everyone else, but anyway, we were qualified to get enrolled. Then I was so happy. The next time the Japanese sensei, Japanese teacher was from Japan, he told me, Bante, you look very happy today. Probably you had lost, you could catch up with the sleep. And then I approached him and said, not necessarily, sir. This is what happened. I explained to him, well, I like the way you motivated yourself. So that is, I have to counter it always. So we have to, that's a good point. That's an excellent question. Now, it is also used as a meditation technique. When you go through something negative, reactivate an experience of something positive that you had experienced before, and use that pleasant experience to counter or to reduce the gravity of that negative experience. And that works. It's good for an amateur or an experienced meditator, for both. So that is the benefit of, pleasant feelings. But when it comes to, in this sutra, Buddha never says that you should avoid both positive and negative. What he says is we need to simply observe both pleasant and unpleasant. When you see the difference, over time we should be able to minimize, we should be able not only to easily understand the negative experiences when you experience something given the moment, you will also be able to see the limits of your pleasant experience. Sometimes the only way to counter our negative experience is to meditate on the pleasant experience. So in that sense, so we would always appreciate it, like most of the time he would appreciate Visakha, right? Visakha, she had a lot of daughters and granddaughters, and it was very hard for the monks to identify, and to a lot of monks, grandma and granddaughters were sisters. And Buddha always say that, live a pleasant life, be happy. And being happy pleasant experience is used as a basis for our continued spiritual practice. Why? Because when you are sad and negative all the time, you wouldn't have time to think. Whereas when you have positive experience, based on that, you can try something anew. Somebody has never been happy in their life. For them, there's no point. If you talk about the value of happiness, your words would go wasted because the other person has never known what happiness is. Before that, you had to buy him a burger or some food, get in some clothing, and you learn that in the Buddha's teaching too. One day a hungry man came. So what happens was, he had taken his cattle to the outer layer of the city. So what happens was, however, he couldn't return. Return home before the city gates were closed, and he has to stay outside of the city limits. And he was very hungry now. He was still looking for the lost cattle. And when he was wandering around looking for his cattle, he happened to drop by the monastery where the Buddha was. When he saw the Buddha, and he was so happy to see the Buddha, and said, okay, he said that something good happened, so I see something better, I should go and ask him some. And he went to the Buddha and says, sir, please, it is quite marvelous that I happened to encounter you like this today. Would you please teach me something? And Buddha was silent, and he said, and Buddha nodded in agreement, and he turned to Venerable Ananda and said, Ananda, please bring this man some food, he's hungry. Buddha first made him happy and then preached. He made him happy. So that's what the Buddhist saying, don't preach to a hungry man. Hungry people don't need your preaching, right?
They need food.
So you have to make someone happy, and then probably then you can... So he went, when he was happy and he rested well, and then then Buddha taught him. And by the time, the cattle were... And then when he went back, he got energized, and then he could find his cattle, and he took them home. So we used that, that incident as a... So that we need to make someone happy. We need to ourselves happy. Because sensory happiness is recommended. But nowhere has Buddha said that sensuous or sensory happiness is bad. If someone says that, it's not Buddha's teachings. It is extreme unrealistic asceticism that we talked about the last week. What was the term that we use? Hedonist and ascetic. Hedonist and ascetic. Over limits. Both asceticism and hedonism can land you in trouble. It has to be the moderation in the middle, even enjoying your life. It has to be moderate. If you are an angry personality by definition, but don't worry about that, because there are other things with your help, with the assistance of your kalyanamitas or friends. You need to see the good side of your life. You are not totally bad. We use that in criminal counseling. You are not totally bad. Mm-hmm. So even a saint would have a demonic side. And even a criminal would have a saintly side, saintly aspect. So that's our over limit. When we are obsessed with happiness, we may land in trouble. When you have chronic anger, so that we would live in denial. And some people go to denial, not because they have nothing to enjoy, but because they have too much. So it's all moderation is the best. Moderation, Majjhima Patipada, last week we talked about that. Mm-hmm. Maybe in a spiritual practice, when you are too much into unrealistic, when you have an unrealistic approach to spiritual practice. I have seen some people. So the people are now having a light moment after a meditation session or something, and there's someone else. Yeah. I think they didn't meditate at all. I'm the one who did meditate. They are now smiling and laughing and talking. I think the typical people, I can't train them. I know some people who actually think that. So who is negative at that point? Who is not spiritual at that point? The very person who thinks that others are wrong. So it's natural. because I have been a monk for many years now, right? Like 36, 37 years now. So that doesn't mean that I am all Puritan spiritual person. I work on my negative feelings. So that's the purpose I am having the robe. That's the reason why it takes a bodhisattva many eons, like billions of lifetimes to come to a satisfactory level of practice, given the fact that his level of enlightenment is supposed to be the highest. Like when you go through the higher the position in your profession, you need more training, right? More training and more experience. That's why when you lie on your CV, right? Yeah. You can. What happens when you lie on your CV? What happens when you lie on your spiritual experience and go to a retreat attended by so many people? I mean, they had meditated life for a long time. It's not the timing as well. So if you go to a retreat simply because everyone else is going, and you wouldn't be meditating, you'd be cursing yourself. I shouldn't have come here. And you open eyes and everyone needs to look very peaceful, why not me?
Is there a concept of self-love?
Yes, it is. There is, yeah.
It sounds like self-love.
Yeah, a lot, yeah. It is associated with what is called raga, or how to say, lust. Lust. Lust, non-sexual lust and sexual lust, both. Because sometimes lustful feelings are not necessarily sexual. However, the Buddhist definition of sexuality is not necessarily making love, but also many objects. Sometimes, did I say my elder brother? He married twice and he divorced. The second time he didn't even go for honeymoon. He married and after the registration he went home, he asked his wife to go home. Why? He's an artist. He would create goddess Athena and all these Greek, Roman goddesses. And he would, the only thing he would do is that he would meditate on those statues with eyes open. Then I asked him, this is the way I satisfy my sexuality. So there are such people, bodybuilders, some artists, meditators. So that is the way. So raga is not necessarily, raga is lustful feelings, happiness, joy. But it's not necessarily sexual as to, just in terms of the fact that you make love with someone. It's based on your perception. So it's the limits. The limits is considered this way. As long as you don't do any harm to anyone else, and as long as you don't harm yourself, you are free to enjoy. And consent. You need the consent from a partner. Even if an underage person gives his or her consent, you are not supposed to. Why? Because it was defined in modern legal philosophy, it was already explained in Buddhist texts. Because that person would, you can provoke someone, motivate someone, you can fool someone. But that's not the word. What is the word?
Entice.
Entice someone. Into,
groom.
In,
hmm?
Groom. Groom, yeah. Hmm? So, and then because that person is deemed to be not, is not supposed to have the cognitive ability to understand the risks and the trouble that he or she is going to encounter. Other than that, and also not with the, if, let's say, you want to make love with someone, before that, I will explain. So you don't have a partner, you are single. The person that you are going out or make love with lies to you and say that he or she is not married. And he or she is a liar. So there's nothing wrong with you then. Why? You didn't lie, they did. So they would be in trouble then. you are not in trouble. They lie to you. So there are different grounds. So the universal is, as long as you don't do any harm to someone else. Harm means ethically. And also yourself too. Because some people are too much into addictions. When your enjoyment are addictive, then you may trouble. So you don't have a right even to harm yourself, including suicide. Okay. Thank you very much for today, coming for today's session. See you next Thursday.